This is an interview with Dr. Marilyn Halpern. This interview was conducted on 11 April 1973 at San Diego State University. The interviewer is Ernest Wing, a member of the oral history class of Dr. Mellon's at San Diego State University. Dr. Halpern is one of two Indians on the San Diego State faculty. The difficulty and adjustments Indians have to make moving from the reservation to the city. You don't mind if I call you Marilyn for an interview?
No, that's fine.
Okay, fine. Could you give me some background information on your life, age, family, marital status?
Oh my. Okay, I'm 43, I'm married, and I have four children. And I grew up on the Six Nations Indian Reserve. I left there when I was 21. Had all my schooling there until I was 14, and then into high school, in the White High School in town.
Where's the Six Nations Indian Reservation at?
Southern Ontario, about 75 miles west of Buffalo Niagara Falls area.
On the Canadian
side. That's why we call them reserves, on the Canadian side.
Are you considered a Canadian citizen?
Not really. No, we're citizens of North America.
Citizens of wards?
Well, yeah, probably wards of North America. We have free border crossing rights. As they tell me, and like with Ray here, he didn't get a green card when he came in. And they said that, for instance, the United States could not stop me coming in, but they can fingerprint me and photograph me. But they cannot stop me from entering the country. So we can go back and forth as we desire.
But you need a green card?
No, not really. In a sense, it's easier to have it for working than not. But you don't really need it. Like Ray's a student and he doesn't have it.
What was your early education like? Did you have mostly white teachers, Indian teachers? Or?
I had all Indian teachers. I went to a one-room schoolhouse on the reserve. We had 12 schools on the reserve, all taught by Indians. All one-room schoolhouses with a little wood stove in it and carted our water in from the wells. No electricity, no electric lights in the school. And we had all 8 grades in one room.
Wow. What was the size of the class?
We had about 27 when I went to school, but then when I taught on the reserve, I had 43 children in grades 1 through 8, the same conditions. No electricity, no water, no heat, nothing.
Did you teach all 8 grades?
All 8 grades. 43 kids in one room.
That must have been a hassle.
Yeah, it really was. Yeah.
How do you keep them separate?
Well, it wasn't really, in a sense, too bad, because if the kids finished their work, they'd listen to what was going on. And then I had set up a table in the corner so they could go back and paint and color and stuff if they wanted to, so they didn't have to stay in their seats. And we didn't have very many books. We probably had maybe about 15, 20 books for the whole school, and the kids would just read those all the time. And that was, but you know, I just teach 5 and 10 minute lessons all around. And then I had one of my little grade 1 children didn't speak any English, so I had to help him and sort of, I would tell him the word in Cuga and then say it in English. So we would know what we were talking about.
Cuga, is that the language of...
Where I come from, they speak all, I guess all 6 dialects, Cuga, Mohawk, Seneca. Most of the kids I taught at that time were Cuba speakers.
Is that language come under the Iroquois Nation?
Right, it's an Iroquois language, yeah. Mm-hmm.
How was your family life when you were in grade school, when you were growing up?
Well, I was really very fortunate, I guess, in a sense, because I'm the youngest in the family. I have 2 older sisters and an older brother. And so there was just my brother and I left at home when I was going to school. and my mother did day work in town, and when the weather got bad, she'd have to go in, say, Sunday evening and not come home until Friday evening. And she'd just stay all week and do day work, and then my dad was mainly unemployed, drove truck once in a while and picked peas and picked prunes, and then he grew a garden and worked on a farm.
What were your living conditions on the reserve?
Well, for many long years, we all lived in one room. Well, my brother and I, my mother and dad, and so it was a one room in which we had a wood stove, and we had no electricity, and no running water, and an outhouse. And we lived that way for quite a while, and then we added another room on, so we had two rooms. And we didn't get electricity until after I left there.
You still had that, I think you mentioned that you had to pump the water?
Well, no, we had to draw it out by a pail. We didn't have a pump. We didn't have a pump until I was really pretty well grown up, I guess. We had to pull it up by the bucket full and carry it into the house.
You say you left the reserve at 21?
Mm-hmm.
To go to school?
No, I got married. That's when I left.
When did you go to college?
After I was married. Didn't go to college before I got married.
And where?
Well, I started off taking a night class. My husband was a student at Berkeley, and so I started off taking a night class in Berkeley, in Extension. I took two classes in Extension. And then when we went back to New Jersey, I then went to night school and took night classes. And so I did about 2 years of college by night classes. Then when we moved to California, I then came to San Diego State full time and got my degree here in 65. So it hasn't been very long I've had my degree.
Did you do your graduate work in San Diego?
Right, at UCSD. And after I finished my degree, then I went and worked for a professor at UCSD. I was a reader for him for 5 quarters when he got me on to going to graduate school. That's how I got to graduate school.
Did you, when you moved from the reserve, did you come to California?
No, I went to Chicago. I lived about a year and a half in Chicago. Then my husband was drafted. Then we went to Aberdeen Proving Ground, Maryland. And we were there for about a year and a half. And then we came to California where he did his graduate work in Berkeley. And then we went back to New Jersey.
How long have you been teaching here at San Diego State?
My first year.
This is your first year?
Yeah.
Did you run into any prejudice, much prejudice as a child?
Well, not in a sense that we could see it as small children because I didn't get off the reserve very much. We were within an all-Indian community, all-Indian people around. When we started to run into prejudice and discrimination was in high school, when we went off the reserve for school.
What kind of discrimination did you run into then?
Oh, kids laughing at us for being Indians. And I remember one time I had a math teacher, that was my first year in high school, I was in grade 10. And she sent us to the board to work some problems, and I couldn't do it. And she said that, well, I just acted like all the other Indians from Six Nations, we were all dumb. And there were a few prejudiced teachers who would try and hold us back and not pass us. And then a lot of the students, for instance, one time I made a white friend and we would have lunch together at school, and I went to her house a couple of times and I asked her to come home with me, and she said she couldn't because she couldn't come out to the Indian Reserve. But I was a nice girl, and her mother said I could go to her house, but she couldn't come to mine.
You said that you had mostly Indian teachers on the reservation
mm-hmm.
in grade school,
mm-hmm.
but then during high school you had to go off the reservation.
Right.
So thereby you had mostly white teachers?
All white teachers.
What city was this?
Brantford, Ontario.
Okay.
The high school population was about 1,300, and all white teachers. No minority teachers at all.
I know that a lot of Indians, American Indians I talk to, experience prejudice during high school from American teachers or Canadian teachers at the same way.
Yes, yeah, just the same. When a race is superior, they're superior in all countries. It doesn't make a difference whether they're Canadians or Americans. But no, I think that basically most of the teachers would just assume not deal with Indian students. That's, I think, why we had such a high dropout rate. And students sense this, and students would leave school. And I remember when I graduated from high school, at commencement, one of the teachers came up to me and said, "Oh, you graduated. Will wonders never cease." I was the only Indian in the graduating class.
After you got married and you went to southern cities like, I mean, states like Maryland, did you run into real discrimination problems there?
Not that I really noticed, more so probably than in terms of housing. We lived in enlisted men's housing, and I guess the blacks bore the brunt of that. And I lived next door to one woman for a while who didn't like the fact that I was an Indian and I was living next door to her, and she always would make my life miserable. But other than that, I didn't really notice it that much. I did remember one time looking in an I looked out of the back window of the apartment, I could see this Indian fellow going in and out of an apartment occasionally. So I went by one day and I said to the woman in the house, I said, "Oh, I keep seeing an Indian going in and out." And she said, "It's my brother." And I said, "Oh," because she didn't look Indian. And I said, "Well, he really looks Indian and you don't." And she said, "No, but he's my brother." And her husband was very blonde and very fair, so, and, you know, I knew he was white. And so I said, I was surprised. I had one Indian friend there, and she was from my own reserve, and I had known her as a girl, so she and I were, that's why maybe I didn't notice prejudice so much, because I had my one friend who was Indian. And so she said to me that if I went any further south, they were Indians from North Carolina. She said if I went any further south, I should be very careful, because the further south you went, the prejudice towards Indians was much worse than it was, say, in Maryland. And the fact that her brother was really very Indian-looking, she said, was much harder on him than it was on her. So I very fortunately, shortly after I arrived in Aberdeen, met one of the girls I knew from home whose husband was also stationed there. So that made my life very pleasant there.
During college, did you run into much discrimination in trying to get an education?
Not as an adult. Maybe by that time you become so immune to it and you get used to dealing with it. I think it's harder as a teenager. I think I would say that at San Diego State that I really didn't. Indians were kind of unusual. And although my teachers knew I was Indian, because I always did papers on Indians, I didn't really notice it that much, no. But as I said, I think really as you get to be an adult, after all I was in my 30s, by that time you become immune to these situations. You're not immune to them, you know how to deal with them.
Right.
That's what I mean.
Did you find it easier getting a job teaching, being an Indian, since they're catering to minorities now?
I don't like to think that, but I would say that probably did help. And I would imagine that a number of my colleagues would say that that's really precisely why I got it. But, I probably was hired under affirmative action. Yeah.
What motivated you in going into a teaching career?
I don't really know. I really thought about why I went into teaching. I just suppose that in my own whole college background, having no other perspective presented, I feel very strongly that one has to present another perspective. for instance, if I'm teaching an Indian class, I feel that I'm teaching it from an Indian perspective and not just from books. And I never took an Indian class as a student because I didn't really feel that I would learn very much, and I could read the books just as well as anyone could present them to me. And I really do think that in many instances it's distorted and stereotyped. And I would sort of feel that maybe I could deal with some of these kinds of ideas rather than having the same old stuff go on and on.
Being that you came from an Indian background, or both of your parents were Indians, I guess that you didn't have no problem adjusting in a white world, rather than if one parent was Indian and one was white, then you wouldn't know which way to go.
Yeah, no. I really came from actually a very strong Indian cultural background. Both my parents' first language was Indian. They didn't learn to speak English until they were 10 or 11. My dad's father was one of the last hereditary chiefs before the government disbanded hereditary chiefs on a reserve. And so he was really very active in Indian affairs. And my mother also was too. She worked in the women's organization on the reserve on Indian Fair. And they were really quite well up. My dad was sent to Ottawa several times on delegations to fight for Indian rights. So I grew up in a household in which it was really pretty Indian oriented. My dad was a traditional longhouse man, which is Indian religion. And so, and although my mother was Christian, I went to longhouse with my dad all the time. So I understood quite a bit of the Indian culture and was raised in it. So I think the only thing that I see is probably harder and hard for a person like that moving into the white world is that they tend to make fun of us because we have such ideas. I mean, if I still adhere to some of my traditional beliefs, people will say, well, you're educated, how can you believe such nonsense? And I find that very difficult to take from educated people. The really disbelief that anybody can have any other kind of beliefs, or any beliefs at all in many instances. Yeah. I think that is one of the things that I probably would feel is hard for me to accept.
Did you have any trouble after living on the reservation most of your early life adjusting to city life?
Yes. Terrible trouble. Just terrible, terrible trouble. When I first went to Chicago, almost 500 miles from my reserve, and I had to go home once a month. I would leave work Friday, we would drive all Friday night and get home for breakfast Saturday morning, spend Saturday and Sunday, leave Sunday night and drive back and be back for work in Chicago on Monday morning. And I would just hate to go back. Oh, I just hate to go to Chicago. And after I had been there for a few months, I couldn't take it any longer, and I packed up and I went back to the reserve for a couple of weeks and just left my job, just said, I'm going. And I did that several times. I just hated Chicago, I hated the city, and I missed my home and I missed everybody there.
What's the difference between the city life and the life on the reservation?
Oh, well, on the reserve, it's really not, you know everybody, and you have a sense of identity of everybody around you. For instance, we used to, the big game where I come from is euchre, it's a card game. So every Friday night, there would be a euchre game, maybe 10, 12 tables playing, and then Saturday night, there'd be a dance, and then there'd be longhouse festivals and all sorts of things going on. When I got to the city, nobody even really cared to talk to me, and I had a terrible time making friends. I didn't make any friends. And I visited an Indian woman who comes from Mohawk from Caughnawaga, Montreal, and I visited her. But I really feel that I never adjusted at all.
Was there any Was there a big Indian
no.
set in Chicago?
At that time, there was not. Indians didn't start moving to Chicago until after that. I was there in 51 and 52, and so there was no Indian organization or any kind of Indian activities in the city. And it was just, I thought it was really lonely. And so I'd go home and stay quite a bit in the summer. I got to Chicago in August, and I went home during the winter. Then I went home again for all of August the following year, and plus every weekend a month. And then after that fall, then my husband was drafted, and when he was sent to basic training, then I went home for 3 months. I went back to reserve for 3 months.
What about when you lived in Maryland, was it easy?
It was easier because I have a sister in New York, and I had a friend from the reserve, and I would spend quite a bit of time up with my sister in New York, and then I would go home periodically, and then my dad was able to visit me too. And so it wasn't nearly as lonely as it was in Chicago. And of course, Maryland, that's just a crossroads on Route 40 anyway. And there's an Aberdeen proving ground. You know, it wasn't a big city life, but I think really having my friend Ruth from the Six Nations was really a lot of help, but I didn't feel lonely. And then my sister would come down and spend time with me, and I'd go and stay with her. So that was much easier for me to think.
Well, being in Maryland wasn't too much different than being on the reservation, was it? Because I'm familiar with Aberdeen. I only live about 80 miles from there.
Oh.
And I know it's only a little cross.
Yeah, just crossroads, so that, you know, I just walk into town and look around. And
I think this town has one main street, that's Route 40.
Right, right, the two restaurants. One was a diner. Yeah, so that wasn't really so bad. But Chicago, I still don't want to go back to Chicago. I really disliked it.
Do you think that it's easier to adjust, that people are friendly around service towns or in service communities than in regular cities?
I never really found service people all that friendly. And it may be because I'm very wary about what people are thinking and what people are doing. And then, as I said, my husband was an enlisted man, and many of the enlisted personnel were white Southerners. And I found them most difficult to deal with. And so I really didn't associate too much, I guess. And then, of course, my husband was from the headquarters company. That was funny, because they had a dance. And all the officers liked to dance with me because I was an Indian. It was something kind of romantic, and I don't think they ever realized it. Thank God. So no matter what it is, whether it's romantic or prejudice, it's never normal.
When you were living in Chicago, the BIA wasn't in...
No, there were no urban things at all.
Do you think the BIA now helps students that come from the reservation into the city?
Yeah, it helps them financially. If you're talking about students now on college campuses, you're talking about Indians coming in on relocation programs, we can say that it helps and it doesn't help. I think that in terms of money, they give a little bit of help, but in terms of any kind of the emotional needs, which to me are the most important rather than the money, I don't think they're meeting the needs, because too many of the Bureau personnel are racist. They really couldn't care about Indians. It's a job they have to do, and as soon as they get their job done, they're happier. I know many of the girls who come on relocation programs are supposed to have follow-up work. They don't. As soon as they get off the project, they're forgotten about. And they have a terrible time adjusting. They don't know where to turn. They don't know who to go for help. And I do think the basic help has come from the Indian community. The girls then, they'll call other Indian people in town, they'll get involved in Indian organizations. And one of the girls I do know who had gotten a job was very unhappy in it, and that was at UCSD, and the Indian students found her a place in another office, and she's much happier. She wasn't window dressing. Her first job, she was window dressing in New York.
There's been some talk among younger Indians that the BIA is a useless organization. They said up until 3, 4, 5 years ago that it was mostly staffed by whites, and now there really isn't that many Indians in the BIA. Is this true?
I don't have the latest figures on it, but somebody quoted me the percentage the other day, 50% Indians. I don't believe it. But I think where we have to start looking at, where Indians, are they in the upper echelons? Who are they in any power decision-making situations? And I would think that we would tend to feel that many are not. And the BIA is a bureaucracy which has gotten to the size now that there's about one Indian, I mean there's about one BIA employee for every Indian, 18 Indians, which seems to be kind of top-heavy on bureaucracy. I think also that they vote, they work to maintain themselves rather than doing anything for the Indians. As an organization, it maintains itself as an organization and forget about its clients. And, you know, it's discussing the BIA question is a double-pronged problem. Because you can talk about the BIA and say you should do away with it, and yet on the other hand, you can't do away with it. It's really just two edges of the same coin. Because if you do away with it, then do you lose land trust status? And if you do away with it, does that mean that, you know, the federal lands are terminated and the Indians won't have at least the reservation land? So most Indians really get caught in a bind, in terms of what the Bureau, what should be done with the Bureau. That it does do a very bad job, I think everyone would agree with. It plays Indian groups off against the others. It's ineffective. It's inefficient. Their educational facilities, the boarding schools, are horrid. And I really don't think I would have much good to say about the Bureau of Indian Affairs. I've talked to a couple of Indian people who left the Bureau, and they said that they told me that you couldn't be an Indian and work within the Bureau. That you would only work within the Bureau if you did not have the concern of the Indians.
I've talked to a lot of younger Indians, and this is the thing they said, that most of the Indians in the Bureau of Indian Affairs are, as they say, apples, mm-hmm. red on the outside and white on the inside. And as long as they're making their little money, then they're satisfied.
That's right, and the people that I know who really were trying to do something for Indians, that's why they left. They went back to their home reservations and they felt they could work there. They said they couldn't work within that structure and still be proud of the fact that they could do something for Indian people.
What's the alternative? You know, it might not be the right game, but it's the only game in town.
Well, I would like to see a restructuring of that whole thing. I'd like to get rid of a lot of those old white men who've been in there for 20-some-odd years. They couldn't care about the Indians. They just want to get retired. The civil service aspect of it, I think, needs to be looked at very, very carefully. I would like to see a lot of the bureaucratic structure disbanded so that if an Indian wants to work within the Bureau, they could do what they could for Indian people and not work for the Bureau, since it is the only game in town, and I agree with that. And that's why it is hard for an Indian to say one way or the other, but I really do think a whole restructuring of it. And I think coming under the Department of the Interior is very bad, seeing what happened in Washington last fall when the BIA takeover. As soon as Louis Bruce, who is then Commissioner of Indian Affairs, wanted to listen to what the Indians had to say, Secretary of the Interior immediately took his position as being superior, got rid of Louis Bruce, and said that he was not capable of functioning. And so I think that if somehow or other it has to be moved out of the Department of the Interior as well.
Do you think they should set up a whole new apartment or department just for Indian Affairs? Do you think that would be much better?
Yeah. I think that if they didn't have to answer to so many levels, it might help. It's hard to really know. I mean, you know, you sort of get caught up in all these things no matter which way you answer. But I really do think that they've got to have more Indians in power positions, and Indians who are really concerned about Indian people, not Indians who have been brainwashed to accept the fact that Indians have to be assimilated and terminated. I don't agree with that.
Do you, the Nixon administration says they have done more for Indians than any other administration. Do you think this is true?
No, I do not. I think that they made just as much lip service. They will talk about self-determination, but they haven't shown that they're going to allow any self-determination. And I think the fact that they transferred a lot of the Indian programs to OEO and then disbanded OEO doesn't show me that they're concerned about Indians. So I think they're just playing the same old game, and Dick's just trying to be a little bit slicker about it, and a little bit, I would think that the gains were started under the previous Democratic administration under the Kennedys. But I would tend to think that from now on we're not going to see as much money going into Indian programs. Certainly, I think the whole cutback on self-determination programs we will see, especially since the programs under OEO were supposedly to work for Indian self-determination, and without OEO, then, because the Bureau of Policy is not to work for Indian self-determination.
Basically, what is the self-determination policy, and what's wrong with it?
Well, I'm for self-determination of Indian projects if they are run by the Indians for the benefit of their own communities. Because you cannot make a blanket statement in Washington that is going to cover every Indian group. You cannot make a policy that is going to cover small groups like we have here in Southern California with 50 people on a reservation or 100 people on a reservation, and then have the same policy go to the Pine Ridge people who have 11,000 on their reservation. There have to be policies which are oriented to those specific regions, different things available for the different people, and have the Indians do it for themselves, because too long now the Bureau, the white people in the Bureau, have been making the policies because they know what's best. And that's, I would see self-determination in the terms of giving the projects over to Indian people.
In the United States, is it true that the Indians really aren't citizens, that they have to apply for citizenship?
Well, according to the Citizenship Act of 1924, they legally are Indians. But then Meredith Quinn says the interpretation of that is only if they show competency. Now, I don't really know. I don't think that's really been put to a legal test. So I don't... That's one of the things that's always confused me. I don't really know.
They have no more up-to-date legislation in 1924-25?
The what?
They have no more up-to-date legislation?
They came... No, the Indian Civil Rights Act was passed, I think, in 68. Because the earlier Civil Rights Acts did not include Indians. So in 68 they came under then the Civil Rights Act. But that's... The legislation since 1924 has been detrimental to the Indians. And so I'm not really clear on how Quinn interprets the non-citizen. I mean, for my own self, I suppose legally we're termed Canadian citizens, although we don't see ourselves as Canadian citizens and we don't see ourselves as American citizens. We see ourselves as members of an Iroquois nation who did not sign a treaty either with the United States or with Canada. Our treaty goes back to, we signed a treaty with Great Britain. And we see ourselves as a sovereign nation, not having recognized either the Canadian or the American.
What would be the advantage in being a sovereign nation?
I don't really know. I've been thinking about that. In terms of us, although we consider ourselves sovereign nations, and they've been making strides now to talk about taxation, I understand now in England and New York State, they don't have to pay sales tax. This was a court case that was decided in favor of the Indians, and so that they now have tax-exempt numbers in which they do not have to pay state sales tax and federal sales tax. The advantage, I suppose, would be a sovereign nation then would deal directly with legislature rather than having the Bureau of Indian Affairs intervene for them. They would deal then with the traditional leaders of the reservations as sovereign nations. That's how I interpret it as. I don't think it's been clearly spelled out.
But there would clearly be an advantage in dealing directly.
Yeah, I think so. And I know that as long as we stand up for our treaty rights that we signed, I think we've gotten definite advantages. I think the mere fact that we can cross both sides of the border and not have to be citizens of either country and still maintaining our rights as Indian people, I think it's been an advantage to us. But I don't know. So I don't really know. When we talk about majority power, is the majority power going? We can only do things if the majority lets us do it anyway. And if they decide that they're not going to play that game, then, you know, then we have to see where that turns to.
Why the great militancy with Indians now?
Gee, I wouldn't call it militancy. I would just sort of call it asking for one's basic human rights, and I don't consider that militant.
Well, any minority movement, they seem to term as militancy.
Well, I don't agree with that, and I feel that the term militancy is thrown along like communism was in the 50s. It means nothing. It's something that you don't want to deal with in majority society, and I just sort of feel that for people to ask for one's basic rights as human beings, I don't think it's militancy. And so I think that's where all the movements are. They're saying, oh, we're tired of being screwed. You know, let us be human beings. And that's why I don't like the term militancy. Russell Means is a militant, and I'm for a lot more of those, I think.
Do you think that the Indians have looked at other movements and say, you know, we got to get our ass in gear and look what they have done. You know, let's get started?
Probably to a certain extent, but I think that everybody's goals are different. Everybody is striving for, you know, within the confines of their own cultural contexts. And I think that each group has worked for their basic rights throughout. I mean, we can talk about the Garveyites, and we can talk about Du Bois, and we can the black, you know, older times. And I think we can look at the Battle of Wounded Knee in 1890 as a last strong defense of Indian people. And so, in a sense, at this point, I suppose we can all look back historically and say that, you know, our forefathers for many generations did these things, although we were cut down. But I'm sure it's really the tenor of the times. I mean, you know, why did the blacks do it when in the 50s and not in the 30s and 40s? I think it's really the point. I felt the film I showed in class the other day, Hunger in America, which said that, you know, this is the richest country on earth, in the world. This is the richest country there has ever been in history. And yet there is so much poverty, so much starvation in the richest country in the world. And I think that times had sort of promoted the fact that we all see what's really happening to us. And so, and I'm sure that the fact that the blacks and the Chicanos have organized and used certain techniques have helped, but yet on the other hand, the Indians are still trying to go back to the basic treaty rights which were given to us, and that's what we see as being very important with our treaty rights.
I understand there are well over 300 treaties being contested in courts.
Right.
Now,
there were over 300 treaties signed, and each one's been broken by a country who never breaks a treaty.
What do you think the result of these court cases will be? You think they'll do like they always done, that they come up with some excuse for the treaty not being in effect?
Yes, because I think that they're going to use the tactic really in the sense that you can't turn time backwards. And yet I think, and there may be some concessions, because I really do think that they can't really, in a sense, treat the Indian people as they've always treated the Indian people. I think that we will get some concessions from them, but I don't think that we'll get, you know, what the different groups are demanding, because it has been pointed out, and it's true, that the United States broke the treaty, the Indians never broke the treaties. They lived up to their side of it. And when it was a little more worthwhile for the United States to break a treaty, they did it. And I think the fact that when they moved out the Senecas and built Kinzua Dam in the 50s, and that was a treaty signed by George Washington, the Senecas fought, and they took it all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court decided that the founding fathers never meant to stand in the way of progress. Hit a lot of people the wrong way, and this is being resurrected too. So I think that there will be some small concessions, but I can't really see that there's going to be a lot.
Do you think that the job market and other avenues of so-called American living has opened up for the American Indians in the city?
Yeah, that's kind of hard to say. I think where they've opened up more is just within the confines of Indian programs. We're employing more Indians on our own projects, and I'm not sure how open it is in terms of the community at large. I don't have any statistics on it, and I'm not really sure, but most people I know are working within the confines of Indian programs. Whether if they're educated, it's in Native American studies, or HEW, or minorities under other programs.
Have education really helped the Indians? The white man's education.
Probably you can say it's helped individual Indians. It hasn't helped Indians as groups. It has helped a few individual Indians, in a sense, to get ahead, in terms of the white man's getting ahead. But it has not helped Indians as a group. No, I don't think so. I think that education has to be changed to educate Indians as Indians, and not educate Indians as white men.
Do you think that'll help them in the job market?
Yeah, it probably will to a certain extent. Majoring in professions. Political science, business administration, these kinds of things. If the avenues are opened within the wider context, it may help. But it was funny, this question came up at a conference a few weeks ago. And I made the statement that, and I think this hold true for most minority groups, you're accepted and your views are accepted as long as they're within the confines of the majority thinking. And if they are within those confines, then your role as an expert or anything else is undermined. And a number of people came up and said they agreed with my point of view, because when they try and say one woman from one of the Indian projects who is an expert in her field, and as she says, when she meets with majority society and tries to point out with, you know, what the Indians really need, she then no longer is accepted as an Indian expert. So it has to be within certain confines and what's acceptable. And so, you know, education, I guess, has helped us understand these kinds of things. I'd say that much.
Do you think the attitude of the white American now, that he isn't responsible for the Indian problem because it wasn't he that done all this to the Indians, but his grandfathers or great-grandfathers, but he shares no responsibility? They seem to have that attitude about most minorities. Do you think that's the correct attitude?
Well, No, I don't think it's a correct attitude, but I think one of the things I do see about the white's attitude towards Indians is there's a little more guilt conscience than there is towards the other minorities. Somehow or other, white people really feel guilty when it comes to talking about Indians and doing things for Indians, but that's as far as it goes. It's just feeling guilty about it. And I think that there does have to be an understanding and a knowledge that maybe individuals per se aren't responsible, but the system they support is. And they may feel that they're perfectly fine human beings, but if they support a system which maintains minority groups, blacks, Mexican Americans, Indians, in the categories they've maintained them in, then something's wrong. Because if you can support a system like that, then you really aren't to blame.
Do you think young Indians today, much more so than in the day when you came to the city, have it much easier for adjustment?
No, I don't think they have it any easier. I think they're still combating a lot of the same difficulties. The only thing that I would say it's nicer now for them to come into the city, say for instance on the college campus with over 50 Indian students, it's nicer for them. They have a program, they've got people to associate with, but other Indians, so they don't have that loneliness. But I still do think that in terms of leaving a reservation and facing a whole world which is unknown, which is strange and lonely and disorienting, those things are still there. But they do have each other now, I think, in terms of, you know, social and emotional support. But it's still difficult.
Do you think the stereotype of the Indians is mostly the same as it was 20 or 30 years ago?
Yes, I really do. I think we still think of movie Indians and TV Indians. No matter what you watch, the Indians are always charging over the hills, yelping, and the Indian and the other view of the Indian, I suppose, the stoic Indian, is a stereotype, and so Indians really aren't seen as people. You know, I mean, it happens in any kind of context today, depending on which situation.